this playing with languages is part of celebrating this story from the Acts of the Apostles about the day of Pentecost, when the Holy Spirit broke through the language barrier and the preaching of the gospel was heard in all sorts of languages. In the past year, several new languages have been added to our normal Sunday liturgy, as we have been joined by new members from different parts of the world. I'm not sure why we're missing our Ukrainian speakers tonight, but that's a pity. It's exciting that we're becoming a more multilingual community and that we've been able to develop ways of celebrating that in our worship. And, of course, tonight's way is just a bit of fun as we flip the normal practice and hear us fumbling through in second languages. Or in the particularly brave case, a language that the person doesn't know at all. So, in honour of all this, I want to have a look at the story of the Pentecost languages miracle and think about what it really means and why it matters. Language and identity are often closely bound up with one another. You may have noticed that anger over language is a feature of many racist attacks. Often when we hear about a race-based hate attack in the streets or on a train or something, it seems to have begun with the attackers taking offence over people speaking a foreign language. And they've begun screaming abuse at them and demanding that they speak in English. And from there it descends into physical violence. You may also remember that many of the attempts at repressive assimilation of minority groups in various parts of the world have begun with attempts to outlaw the speaking of the languages of those minority groups. And this didn't just happen in other countries. It was a part of the infamous White Australia policy here too, and it was still happening in the not-too-distant past within memory of many of us. Listen to this extract from Stan Grant's extraordinary recent book, Talking to My Country. He said, "In the middle of the 20th century, my father's language was dying. It had largely vanished, wiped out by missionaries and government officers who forbade it. My father caught the last utterings of Wiradjuri. His grandfather was among the final keepers of the traditions and ceremonies, and he would speak in the bush to my father, educating him in the way that he and his father before him had been educated. But once he made the mistake of calling to his grandson in front of the whites. Downtown Griffith was no place for this. The police arrested him and he was jailed. When he came out, he refused to speak his language again." The Boomerang language of this locality died out in similar ways and for somewhat similar reasons, although, to be fair to the missionaries in this case, the only bits that were preserved by a missionary linguist who actually encouraged the language, but the policies of repressing were similar. The psalm that we sang in it before is one of the few surviving records of that language. Why is language such an inflammatory issue? Why does it stir up such hostility and violence? And what does this have to do with the gospel? Much of the answer has to do with fear. But it's multi-layered. It's not a simple fear. There are various sorts of fear associated with language. I remember well the first time I found myself alone in the streets of a country where I couldn't speak a word of the language. It was actually your country, Geeta. It was in Germany, but it was in East Germany where not so many people speak English either. And the thing that surprised me was how terrified I was. I've actually done it lots of times now in different places and it doesn't terrify me anything like the same, but it really did the first time. It wasn't that I thought that the people were unfriendly or that I was in danger of being attacked or anything like that. It was just that I am so used to being very confident in my ability to communicate and very confident that whatever might go wrong, my communication skills will enable me to negotiate my way through the perils. And yet here I was, suddenly stripped of what is usually my most powerful asset, my communication skills. I didn't even know how to order a sandwich in a shop, and if something went seriously wrong, I would not be able to talk my way out of it. I felt entirely helpless. And that experience has given me some measure of understanding and perhaps even a little compassion for those who feel threatened by others speaking languages they don't understand. It can be especially sharp if you feel a bit inadequate about your capacity to understand what's going on around you, even in your first language. And if perhaps you are surrounded by fairly unpredictable and violent local culture. If violence is an ever-present threat, then people speaking in another language could be plotting against you and taking advantage of your inability to understand. So if you're already living in fear and you want to be able to keep track of what's being said and done around you, then people speaking other languages can make you feel quite insecure. Mostly, though, I think the issue is a deeper layer of fear than that, the fear that leads to the violent attacks on foreign speakers. Most angry, violent people live surrounded by lots of other angry, violent people. And so they live with a constant sense of danger. At any moment, all that hostility and angst could boil up and explode. And so you live with the scary knowledge that it is often pretty random and you could easily be the next target when it blows up the next time. So what we tend to do if we're constantly afraid like that is that we do whatever we can to make sure that it is someone else and not us who is the most likely target. We protect ourselves at the expense of someone else by treating someone else with suspicion and hostility and aggression in the hope that everyone else will agree with us and thus be united against someone who is not us. And of course, that strategy, which is always quite unconscious, we don't realise we're doing it, it's much more successful if the person or group that we direct our hostility towards is noticeably different from our group in some way, such as racial appearance or language. And if they're relatively powerless so that our violence towards them is not likely to cause a wave of retaliatory violence that is too big for us to handle. So that sort of hostility and suspicion is almost always directed towards minorities. And the more distinctive and the more isolated, then the more likely they are to be targeted. That's why there are no neo-Nazi skinheads in Jerusalem. Nobody picks on a powerful majority. Now, before we go feeling all superior in our middle-class educated niceness, this phenomena is not just confined to an angry, uneducated, bogan class. All of us, when we feel under attack, will instinctively find ourselves wanting to react by pointing the finger and crying, "What about them?" It's virtually universal. It's part of the basic structure of human sin. And it has thoroughly infected all religions, including Christianity. It's not always expressed in violent assaults, but religious groups are notorious for shunning and persecuting groups who they identify as the evil other. We have shunned and persecuted Jews, Muslims, Africans, women, divorcees, homosexuals, liberals, fundamentalists. We justify it as being a righteous assault, a sort of righteous crusade against sin and wickedness. We see ourselves as siding with God, who allegedly hates these evildoers. But most of this hostility is driven by the same motive as the racial hatred that I was just describing. Because if somebody is going to begin violently purging the world of sinners, we need to make sure it's some other kind of sinners, not the kind that includes us. We can reassure ourselves that we are the good people who will be safe if we can identify sin and evil somewhere else. If they are the evil ones, then we must be the good ones, and so we'll be exempt when the judgment comes. Of course, often this fear is not really about God and some imagined future judgment by God. It's actually about each other. We're fearful of being judged by one another and branded as abominable sinners and shunned and attacked ourselves. So we eagerly join crusades against other categories of sin. The Christian left is no better than the Christian right in this regard, or the right and left in the wider community for that matter. Just look at the wave of hostility directed at Margaret Court over the last few weeks. I share the abhorrence of her vilification of sexual and racial minorities, but if we simply reciprocate her hostility, we're playing the same divisive game. We just point the finger at each other and the world stays divided. We identify them as the problem, and because we have identified them as the problem, we feel secure in the knowledge that we are not the problem. But of course, the real problem is the need to keep securing our own identity and security at someone else's expense, dividing ourselves up into an us and a them. This is precisely what was so remarkable and extraordinary about what Jesus did. He came among us and willingly stood out as different, as strange, almost inviting us to turn on him as the odd one out, as the vulnerable minority, so that the one who we could all join in persecuting to keep the anger of the mob safely deflected away from ourselves. And by putting himself in that place and willingly surrendering himself to our crusading hostility, he achieved several astonishing things. He unmasked the lies of the system, the lie that said that those crusades were authorized by God and conducted on God's behalf, and the lie that said that we good people only ever attack the truly evil, and that we can accurately tell the difference between the truly evil and the good that is epitomised by us. But then, beyond simply unmasking the lies, Jesus achieved something even more astonishing. He proved that becoming the persecuted one is not nearly as fatal as we thought it was. Even crucified to death, Jesus rose up more alive than ever, and even freer than before, to show that we can safely follow him, knowing that the life and love of God will hold us securely, even if others turn on us. And that security saves us from needing to join in with the finger pointing and the crucifying. It sets us free to be part of the solution instead of part of the problem. So the Spirit that was poured out on the fledgling church on the day of Pentecost was the Spirit of Jesus, the same Spirit that shaped him and inspired him and empowered him to courageously side with the world's victims, even to the point of becoming the ultimate victim of our hostility and violence. So when this Spirit is poured out on us, it is a Spirit that has absolutely nothing to do with our desire to divide ourselves up into rival mobs, whether the lines be ethnic or linguistic or sexual or theological. Instead, it is a spirit that breaks down the barriers, that builds bridges instead of walls, that heals divisions and reconciles former enemies. So when this wild and crazy spirit drove the previously fearful apostles into the streets and empowered them to begin preaching the good news of Jesus in the languages of all those they encountered, it was an unmistakable sign that the new culture of God, in which all are welcome, is a culture in which our diversity is cause for celebration instead of suspicion. And when we here in this place find ways of celebrating the diversity of languages among us by regularly including everyone's first languages in our worship, and today for a bit of fun including some stumbling second languages as well, we're seeking to enact the same sign. Now, that might be quite a small thing, and at one level it is, but if it is a sign of a bigger transformation that is happening within us and among us, then it will ultimately be no small thing at all. We will truly be allowing ourselves to be blown by the wind of God's Spirit out of the hellish enclaves of frightened conformity and repressive assimilation and out into the pathways of Jesus, where we can rejoice in the rainbow diversity of God's creation and celebrate God's reconciling and all-inclusive love that heals the world and creates a place of belonging and security that we were all longing for.